What's going on, fellow 45-year-olds? You have pressed play on the inaugural Magnet Magazine podcast. This is Numero Uno. And you guys are all in luck because you get to spend time with the minds behind the premier indie magazine, the premier monthly indie magazine, indie rock magazine in the United States. And, you know, I think as literate and, you know, acerbic and informed as Magnet is, you all need to prepare yourselves for the complete opposite in the form of this podcast. I am Andrew Bonazzelli, the very in the time span of Magnet, very briefly the managing editor. To my right,
2 years,
something like that. Yeah. To my right, the editor in chief, Mr. Eric Miller.
Hello.
And to his right, the star, you would say, the shining cover story penning. Supernova of Magnet, the Jonathan Vlania.
The Joe Namath of Magnet.
The Joe Namath.
I'm sure that reference will not be lost on all the kids that are going to be listening to this.
It means a lot to me as a Jets fan, which is to suggest that he was successful once and otherwise was a flamed out nightmare of a human being, copious drinker.
He wore pantyhose once. You know about that? He did the pantyhose ad. My grandfather would never watch a Jets game after that. He was like, he was ruined.
That's what turned me on to the whole thing.
I think I'm the Steve Tasker of Magnet. I get beat up on every play.
And a hustle guy.
See, I'm so out of the sports loop, I don't even know what that means.
He was the special teams guy for Buffalo Bills in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
He would do like the special, like the operations where they'd wear the black.
Yeah, he would do black ops basically for the Bills. Yeah, that was his deal.
Yeah. the knife in his teeth, swimming on the boat.
He was deep undercover.
So now that we all have a horrible football doppelganger to supplement our personalities, we should tell everyone why we're here, which is to celebrate the recently released, not the recently released, but the entire gamut of Magnet, which is, we just put out our 100th issue. And it's a weird time to celebrate it because in real time, we're actually working on issue 103 and we've totally forgotten about this fucking thing.
Right.
We have a lot to say about it. There's a bit of a weird time lapse going on. I think, Eric, you should get us going by telling the few uninitiated who have pressed play on a Magnet podcast what they really need to know about the last 20 years of this magazine.
Yeah, no, it started in 93 and... You know, we started out monthly and then became quarterly at some point and then stopped publishing for a couple of years and now we're back to monthly. So coincidentally, after all this time, 20 years coincided with 100 issues, which is sort of cool. You know, we've detailed a lot of the specifics within the issues over the years, but it's... you know, it's a completely independent magazine. You know, if you would have seen some of the places that we've worked over the years, you would just know how low budget it is. But, you know, now, you know, since we started publishing again in 2011, you know, we've been monthly and things have been going really, really great. So, you know, we've had like 5 different offices and, you know, a bunch of them have been crap. We've had, you know, this is a new staff now, but, you know, I mean, I've been the one consistent. And so, you know, I think that's kept Magnet sort of similar over the years to what it started as.
He's not telling the whole story here. He's being false modest. The magazine started out as like a counterpart to this like cheesy local rock rag called Philly Rock Mag that was like this like...
Philly Rock Guide,
right, okay. And then the guy that actually started the publication lost interest in doing a national magazine real quick, and he wanted to keep sticking with Philly Rock Guide and basically, you know, making money off of J.C. Dobbs ads and Kuiper Pass.
The legendary like J.C. Dobbs.
Yeah. So the magazine was about in free fall, was about to go out of business, and Eric took it upon himself to keep it going, keep it alive, which meant moving home to Morrisville, New Jersey, and living in his parents' basement
Yardley,
for like 9 years. Well,
yeah. What? Same thing. Successful things come from parents' basements.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So,
other than handkerchief, you know, accumulation.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, it's, you know, it, I was 21 when it started. I was a student at Temple University, and the three other people who I started it with, and I had no financial investment in the company whatsoever. I was just sort of an unpaid person who spent way too much time doing it.
Not much has changed then.
Yeah, exactly. But the other people I started with were all 30. After us not making any money off the first year and a half of issues, and being monthly, so there was a bunch of issues. They all started families and getting married and moving to the suburbs and all that stuff. And they were obviously not really interested in, you know, investing their life in this. And I was, so I moved home.
I was
a loser. So I moved to my parents' basement and, you know,
it's like Chris Elliott should play you
yeah,
the TV
exactly,
show.
I was thinking more Edward Norton, maybe. But
you do have 25th Hour hair right now, actually.
Yeah.
Not so much the balding, schlumpy, hive-ridden Chris Elliott thing going on.
Yeah.
Painting a picture for the audience.
Yeah, thank you.
Three. Continue.
So we needed to find an art director, and I had gone to high school with this woman, Kimberly, who went to art school, Parsons, in New York, and had never really done graphic design, but had started using a computer. This is like back in before everyone had a computer and no one really had email. So she started doing it. Of course, she went to art school and spent a shitload of money going to art school. And so when she graduated, she became a waitress. And then that didn't pay enough, so she got a second waitressing job. So in between those jobs, she started art directing. So it was basically two of us in the office. And yeah, I've said this a couple of times in the magazine that I would answer the phone in different voices to give the illusion that I wasn't the only person there. So, you know.
Embrace schizophrenia.
Can you do any of these special voices? Can you show us some of these?
I don't remember them. Yeah. There was too many drugs back then. So eventually.
We're going to edit that part out.
Drugs, right?
Because my mom listens to this.
Yeah. So, sorry, Mrs. Valenia.
She doesn't know.
Yeah. So eventually moved back to Philly, you know, started developing a staff. That was like about 97. And published consistently from 97 to 2008. A number of factors sort of kept us from publishing after the end of 2008. And then in 2011, we started partnering with Red Flag Media, who also publishes Decibel, which is a great heavy metal magazine that Andrew also works on. And since then, we've been monthly and back in the game, and things are going great.
You know, I have a pretty important question. The first issue, I believe, I should have known this already, but you informed me today that it was Urge Overkill.
Yes.
How pissed were they that they didn't get on the 100th issue?
Are they still around? Didn't Blackie Onassis, the drummer, he like disappeared or something? And I don't know.
The one guy's been touring. The main guy, who's the singer guy with the sunglasses.
Which
Nash
one?
Nash Kato?
Yeah, good.
Nash Kato,
good.
The main
Nash
guy?
Kato, yeah.
Oh, there was Nash Kato and King Reeser.
King Reeser or whatever.
Reeser,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, for the record, their version of Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon is one of the greatest moments of indie rock ever. And it's better than the original version.
Just no, it's not. No one trumps Neil Diamond, John.
I just said that it was.
Ask about Urge Overkill because I recall an anecdote that I remember Albini saying that after they had a falling out, let's see which of us is still making music in 10 years and which of us is sucking dick at bus depots for pocket change.
Right.
Which of us is on the cover of Magnet.
What cracked me up about Urge Overkill is they used to call Albini, when they were having that feud, used to call him Old Puddinhead.
I think one of our friends had a story when Urge played the Khyber. When they sort of got back together, I'm not sure how many years ago it was, and Pat had just interviewed them and introduced himself when they walked in, and they said, "Do you know how to get any coke around here? Like right now?"
What year is this?
This is probably like 8 years ago, maybe.
8 years ago.
Yeah.
Urge Overkill, keeping it real.
No, and but I mean, I have to say, in 93, they put out Saturation, and it's still. It holds up. It's a great record.
They recorded that record in Philadelphia, which is kind of part of the deal. So they were hanging here a lot. And
there you go.
The magazine's obviously based out of Philadelphia.
That's a big point of pride.
And I partied with them one night. It's partied. I drank some beers with them, but I didn't have any Coke.
Yeah. Now, actually, Larry, who's one of the other
Pepsi,
the other three people I started a Magnet with, he and I were at the studio when they recorded some of that. And I mean, they're sort of the not to talk about Urge Overkill, because probably most people listening to this, if anybody actually is listening to this, don't give a shit about.
They're
Urge all
familiar
Overkill.
Sister Rowena.
Yeah. Yeah. Hello, Mom. But, you know, there was a rumor going around at the time that they actually brought in other musicians, you know, and which is, if you listen to their older stuff compared to that, there's a drastic difference in, you know, the professionalism of the playing. And then I remember Larry, who, like I said, one of the people I started Magnet with, he and I went to see them at the Troc after that came out. And so psyched, you know, they're on the cover of Magnet, you know, they're going to be the next biggest band post Nirvana, everything's great, and saw them play live, and we were kind of like, ugh.
Well, they couldn't pull it off? They couldn't do the record live?
No.
Yeah, them and Veruca Salt.
Right.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I don't know what to say, what more to say about Urge Overkill, except I want to do drugs with them now instead of being here. Obviously, Urge, the first band on the cover of Magnet. Number 100, the fourth or fifth appearance of Guided by Voices and Bob Pollard.
I think 14th or 15th appearance.
Yeah, no, I think it was five individual covers and one we did a year of music where we picked other luminaries from that year, like DJ Spooky, and put like five people on the cover. No, there's some other good people. I think there's Moby and Yellow Tango and... but yeah, no, it seemed like a natural for issue 100 because, I mean, we've sort of been associated with Guided by Voices and Bob Pollard for so many years, you know, and like
conflict of interest time, have had a couple drinks with Bob Pollard from time to time.
Yeah, no,
possibly.
Both of you. Yeah, no, I mean, I've done a cover story. John's done two on him.
I went to his house out in Dayton, Ohio for the first, I think it was the first cover story, wasn't it?
No.
Okay.
It was like, I think the 13th. 17th, yeah.
Whatever. It was back in like 99 or something like that. And I was a huge, I still am a huge Guided by Voices fan, but that was really kind of like going to rock and roll fantasy camp. It's like you go to Bob Pollard's house and, you know, you go down in the basement and yell into his four track and, you know, you go drink beer with him and his factory drinking buddies.
The basement, the snake pit?
Snake pit is what it's called, which keeps his vinyl collection. He has like his little drinking, but this is called the clubhouse. It was like a shed they built out in the back that had a urinal in it where they'd always hang out and drink.
Monument Club,
right? Mm-hmm. Basketball court, just driving around the college, the school that he used to teach at. There's a funny story that we wound up in some godforsaken strip club in Dayton. Nearby there, it's me, Bob Pollard, and his brother Jimmy, who's a real character.
Jimmy's awesome.
Jimmy was pretty lit. I guess we were all pretty lit, but we got thrown out because he told one of the dancers that she had the best fart box in Dayton.
Finest fart box
in Dayton.
It makes all the difference.
And I don't know. I mean, is that grounds for getting? That's grounds for getting kicked out of a. I think the bar is pretty low if that gets you kicked out of a strip club.
No, I told Andrew this morning if you get kicked out of a strip club in Dayton, something's wrong. Like that really shouldn't happen. No offense to Dayton or strip clubs.
Definitely not to fart boxes.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd never heard that term before. He put it in the story, but I think I remember you telling me that Bob told you that Jimmy had. Come up with shtick before you got out there because he wanted to be in the story saying funny stuff.
Keeps working on his material. Yeah, I didn't know that.
He worked a coin for it, fart box.
Yeah, I did a cover story on them when Under the Bushes, Under the Stars came out in 1996, and this is when we were still when I was living with my parents. And so we did the photo shoot that morning, and Kimberly, who was the art director at the time, she and I took the train up. And
Kimberly, who is now his wife, he's not saying.
Right.
Yeah, were you guys boyfriend and girlfriend when she started as art director, or did that blossom?
I don't know how that matters, and you're embarrassing both of us.
It's
but,
important. It's an old comic come to
life.
Very opposite of Daniel Close, I guess.
So we took the train up, and they had never really done a photo shoot before, and this is like we were on such a small budget that the photographer, Christian Lantry, who did a lot of the classic Magnet covers and also, you know, traveled to do Magnet covers with John for Tom Waits and other people. So this is right when he had first started shooting for us, and we couldn't afford a studio, which kind of like now. So he had a friend who had a house that we were able to shoot at, and it was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and there was like 10 people living there, 8 of which were there. There was the 5 people in the band, or 4 people in the band. They didn't have a steady bass player at the time, and their publicist, and me, and Kim, and Christian, and, you know, I mean, we basically filled this place up, and we did it super early. It was like 9 in the morning or whatever, and they weren't used to New York, so they were being sort of freaked out a little bit. So we did the shoot, and then later I met up with Bob at this total dive bar that no longer exists that I had been to with Kim one New Year's Eve on the Bowery called Phoebe's. And it's a place where, I mean, you go to drink. I mean, there's no other possible reason to go there. So between he and I, we drank 5 pitchers of beer.
No Big Buck Hunter?
No.
No Golden Tea?
No.
You can just drink there. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Just checking. Yeah. No, I know. So at that point, it had gotten late. This pre-cell phone era, you know, I realized I had supposed to go back on the train.
I think you should point out here that Eric weighs about 80 pounds, right, too. So five pitchers of beer will do it.
I have two wooden legs, or used to.
Go ahead.
So we went back to Matador office and went through some of the Under the Bushes artwork. And then we met up with the rest of the band at this Mexican restaurant and drank more and more. And then decided that we'd all go out afterwards. And like I said, at this point, they never had a permanent bassist. So we go to this bar where the guy from Don Caballero was bartending, and Mark Eibold from Pavement was there, like all these indie rock scenesters or whatever. And
icons.
Yeah, icons. So everyone just sort of assumed that I was their bass player because it was me and the other guys. And remember Pete Jameson, John?
Oh, yes. Manager for life.
Manager for life, which lasted about...
That didn't really work out.
No.
Well, unless he's dead.
Yeah, no. So people were just buying me beers and everything. And then we went outside. It got hot and smoked some pot. And I was just wasted. And so...
Good to cut that part out.
Yeah. Bob had told me I could stay with him at his hotel room. So I went back inside and see him, you know, walking ahead of me. So I tap him on the shoulder and said, you know, Bob, I got to go. I'm wasted. The person that turns around is this middle-aged woman who had similar hair to Bob at the point. So I was like, sorry. She's like, you're drunk. I said, yeah, no shit.
And you made out with her?
Yeah, no. So I finally found Bob, and he has no idea what hotel he's staying in. We get a cab. We go a half a block. The cab driver kicks us out because we're so drunk. Finally find another cab, you know, and then sing Guided by Voices songs the whole way back to the hotel. You know, crash, wake up. I'm like more hungover than I've been in my life. I have to take a train home. And Bob and the band goes out and starts drinking and doing more interviews. So, there you go.
I think that's a better story than I have, man. You guys really...
No, it's funny because I had to call my parents to let them know that I wasn't coming home, and I didn't want to say that in front of the band, so I said, I need to go call my 2 roommates.
The moral of the story being, Under the Bushes is where one finds the fart box.
Yes, I think that's it. But, yeah, so no, it's really...
Maybe not pluralizing bushes, but, you know...
Right. But it's cool. It's cool that we did Bob. Bob fart doesn't boxes. Do very many interviews anymore, so it was cool that we have him on 100th issue and really appropriate. And we
and he loved the shit out of it too. He loved it. That was a great piece.
He wrote us a letter via email, which he doesn't have email, so he has his girlfriend send it to his manager.
His wife.
Yeah, send it to his manager, who sends it to us. But and it's sold amazingly. It was literally sold out. We sold out all the office copies before the issue even hit the streets.
Oh, really?
But, yeah.
Uh-huh. A little ego boost.
Yeah.
Yeah, well. Yeah. Told you, stick by me.
Yeah. John, how many cover stories have you, can you even quantify it? Magnet cover stories.
Well, since we restarted, I think I've done almost all of them except for like two or three. I don't know. 20? 30?
No, more than that.
30-ish?
I'd say if we've done 101, you've probably done at least a third of them.
Right. Yeah,
so I guess that would be around 30.
I can't believe it's been 100 years
yeah, I know,
since we started.
Yeah.
And your experience before this was also Philly Rock Guide, is that right? Also Philly Rock Guide, is that right? City Paper?
No.
Yeah.
The way I got hooked up with these guys, if you must know, is I actually was playing in my own band at the time. I was a lead singer of a band called the Cyclone Rangers, who were signed to Capitol Records, or a subdivision of Capitol Records, back in the early 90s. And this was back right when Magnet was kind of just starting out. And I remember we played at New Music Seminar, or I guess New Music Seminar, when back in the still was a New Music Seminar, or maybe it was CMJ, one of those two. But anyway, our publicist had organized this sort of like press dinner for all these, you know, for all the sort of magazine writers and whatnot, and at this place called Lucky Chang's, which I think is still in operation in the Lower East Side. All the waiters are drag queens, and a Chinese restaurant, a fancy Chinese restaurant. And Eric, I wound up sitting next to Eric, I guess, and we just kind of started talking, and I guess I let slip that I actually had an English major. And a couple months later, when they were so hurting for someone to write about Superchunk, they called me up, and the rest is history.
Yeah, we weren't actually sitting next to each other, though we did talk, and that's sort of how it started. But actually, you know, who I sat next to, or across from, because I showed up late, they had that one big table in the middle, and when I showed up with Tom Reimel, who also used to work at Magnet, they didn't have enough room at that table for us. So, they put us at this other table, and this other couple, a man and woman, showed up late, and they sat across from us. It was the four of us, and we're talking, and he said, "Oh, what do you do?" I said, "I'm editor of Magnet," and, "Oh, I love that magazine." And, but throughout the whole night, all these people were coming up and asking him for autographs, and I had no idea who he was.
Right.
And I said, "This is really weird. Why?" You know, no offense, but I want to ask you, obviously you're famous, but I have no idea who you are. And he's like, "Well, I play in a band called Rage Against the Machine." It was Tom Morello.
Tom Morello.
And who I guess, I think he was dating or married to someone who worked at your label.
Yeah, that's right. There was that connection.
And the nicest guy in the world. And, you know, I never listened to Rage Against the Machine at that point. And I tried to after that and stopped. But
no, we just got a 20th anniversary box of the first self-titled album. And I recall many moments when Eric was not having it.
Yeah. No, he and Tom.
Eric does not rally around the family with a pocket full of shells.
You know what? I couldn't really. I was not into them at the time. Rap rock. It was not my scene. But looking at it now, man, I think those guys were one of the great, like, rock with the social conscience, rather, bands that ever was. I really think that they were rock and roll in the classic sense. I doff my hat to them. I still don't know if I'd sit down and listen to a whole record about them, but
no. And he at the time too, you know, he was so into indie music and know all the bands that we covered, was familiar with Magnet, and you know, so just, you know, a great guy, and obviously really into music, obviously really, really smart. And his soul, the Night Watchman, is that what it's called?
Yes.
I like some of that stuff. And, you know, he's
more protesty, acoustic.
Yeah.
But just to finish up on Rage, though, they are like the, you know, all these bands, you know, you also work for the Metal magazine, and everyone's trying to be really scary and evil and dark and all this kind of stuff. Rage Against the Machine is like the one band that actually makes the fucking system quake in their boots. You know what I mean? Because the topics they're addressing. And I just want to, I don't know why we're devoting so much time to Rage Against the Machine.
We can devote a lot
more. Really a Magnet thing, but I just wanted to get that out there on the record.
Maybe we can talk about Korn now.
We actually opened for Korn one time.
Lucky.
The Cyclone Rangers, we were in Atlanta. I had no idea who Korn was. And they're like, "You're going to play with Korn." And like, I remember they had this big bus that was out in the parking lot of the club in the afternoon. And it was just like a line of kids lining up to get their autographs. Like, who are these guys? And another band on the bill was Sister Ray, which is another band I had never heard of. And then both these bands went on to become ginormous. And
wait,
I went on
band?
To become a freelance writer.
Yeah. Who's the other band?
Sister Ray. Isn't it Sister Ray?
Sugar Ray?
Sugar Ray. Man, my memory is totally shot. Sugar Ray. What was that? what was their big song?
Fly.
You can fly.
Yeah, I just want to fly. Put your arms around me, baby.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Yes, yeah, Mark McGrath, isn't that his band?
Absolutely, Mark McGrath, yeah.
I just remember they had nice suits. The guys from Korn all wore like these silk tracksuits.
John, having not heard your band, did you belong in that lineup? I'm just curious because Korn and Sugar Ray are sort of like...
No, we were totally just like a sore thumb.
Is new metal, is it?
Well, and then I went out and I remember because I was like big into being a smart ass back then. Not much has changed really, but I went out and I mean, there was probably like 4,000 people there. And I said, oh, didn't you hear Korn canceled? And like, oh my God, that was the wrong thing to say. I mean, they were just throwing things and booing for the whole... Not that we were going to win these kids over with our indie rock.
Right.
We weren't quite stomping enough for those guys. But anyway.
We need to concentrate on winning the kids over with our indie rock.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean...
the hearts and minds of...
Yeah, no, I think...
Well, that's why I insisted that we do Tame Impala for this issue, that we have somebody under 40 on the cover of the magazine at least once a year.
Right, right.
And it was a real struggle to get Eric to agree to this.
We've had some good-looking white kids recently.
Yeah.
Some good bearded white thin folk.
Yeah. Tame Impala's on the cover of 102, which is the next issue. The only thing that's not in and ready to go is John's story on it.
Who's that?
But I was in Australia. Give me a break.
Yeah,
took 35 hours to get there one way.
Well, the story started 25 hours, and then it was 30, so now it's 35. So I guess
it'll
by the time
48 that, by the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Uphill both ways in the snow.
Barefoot.
Right. I was just thinking that, obviously, if it hasn't been emphasized enough in this podcast, which it has not, Magnet is pretty much right now the, preeminent premier indie rock monthly magazine. Not much competition just by virtue of there not being many print magazines related to niche stuff like indie music, metal, etc. Just a question from someone who wasn't there but might know the answers. Who were Magnet's arch rivals back in the day?
When we started, we totally looked up to... There was Option, there was Alternative Press. Alternative Press is not even recognizable.
It's changed a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. But Jason Pettigrew, the editor at AP, he's been there forever. He's somebody I knew and had similar tastes in music to, and we would hang out at music conferences. Option was really good. Raygun was still around.
I thought Raygun was pretty cool.
Yeah. You couldn't really read it.
With text.
Yeah.
This story's upside down.
Yeah,
Whee!
Exactly.
Oh,
where's the end of this story? Where's the beginning?
Well, this is probably getting really inside baseball, but I think Magnet wind up being the Option of the 90s, which is all right with me because I read Option in the 80s and thought it was a really cool magazine and found out about stuff I didn't know about. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was cool and it was glossy and it had good smart writers and stuff like that.
Yeah, no. And so we sort of, at that point... major labels were signing all kinds of indie bands like Jawbox and those kind of bands who had no commercial viability. But, post Nirvana, they were just every label was just trying to sign somebody who could be the next Nirvana, like the Jesus Lizard, all these.
Cyclone Rangers.
I mean, all these
Helmet.
Bands. Helmet. Yeah. I mean, all these bands that didn't deserve or shouldn't have been on major labels, because they were doing what they're doing. It was great.
What would Andrew Earle say about this? What would Andrew Earle say about this?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think we should point out that there's been a shift in the industry since then. That back then you couldn't be an indie band and make the leap to major labels for some reason. You would lose your old audience and you wouldn't gain a new audience, and then your career would kind of be over. And that happened to so many of those bands that signed
until you were reassessed in 2013.
Right.
But now the industry is like, well, because they'd also put you through this cookie cutter. You had to sound like everybody else on the radio, and so basically you wouldn't sound like yourself anymore. Or what was ever was special or unique about you, and just people lost interest in you. But now things, I think, are way more interesting, that the industry's become so small and that radio plays such a small role in things anymore. I just think there's so much more interesting stuff is getting through and blowing up big, like Tame Impala, like a band, like they're really big, like worldwide. It just kind of blows my mind because back in like when Magnet first started out, there'd be a band that sold like 5,000 copies, and like we'd all be like, if only they could play their song on the radio, they'd be huge. And now it's like that. I think it's actually far more interesting times for indie music, or for not you know, not mainstreamy kind of stuff, mm-hmm. middle of the road kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I told Andrew this story earlier, but you know, back then the economy was better. Major labels and even some indie labels. Stop looking at your watch, John.
We're getting paid by the hour.
Yeah, yeah. They were throwing so much money behind all these bands. You know, they would fly writers places. They would have these press junkets. They were just spending a shitload of money on everything. And we would get stuff, promo items in the mail. And the one thing at the first Magnet office that we got was a bong from it was a Sacred Reich bong, yeah. That band Sacred Reich. They're on Hollywood Records, which at the time was owned by Disney. And so back then we used to fire up the bong a handful of times a day at the office. And so it got a lot of use. And then in one issue of Entertainment Weekly, they did a little blurb saying that this Disney-owned company sent out this Sacred Reich bong to journalists, and Disney flipped. So we get this letter in the mail saying that we need to send the bong back. But at this point, I mean, it was so dirty and filthy and disgusting. And it's just like, there's no way we can send this in the mail. That, I mean, we're going to all get arrested. So that's my biggest regret from Magnet is not knowing what happened to that Sacred Reich bong. Because we mentioned this earlier, but when I split from the old publisher, he decided... one day we went into work right before this was all happening, and he said, I'm breaking the lease with the landlord from this building. I'm not telling him. You need to get all your stuff out by tomorrow. So it was me, Tom, and Jill at that point. Jill was the art director at the time. And so we're just like, shit. I mean, we don't have any money. We need to get all the stuff out tomorrow. We can't afford to hire movers. So she's, oh, I have this friend, Maddie.
Blow it up.
Who,
wait, no?
Okay. No, yeah. I have this friend, Maddie, who has a truck, and he'll help us move. So we moved all of our stuff out that night under the cover of darkness, except for the back issues, which then the landlord had taken hostage and made us buy them back from him, which is always nice, paying for magazines twice when you don't have any money.
Mm-hmm. Your own magazines.
Yeah. So Jill's friend, Maddie, moved all her stuff to Jill's house, and she rented this place, and she rented... space in the bottom of it out to bands or whatever. And if it wasn't for this guy Maddie with the truck, I don't know what we would have done. And it turns out Maddie is Matt Pond, and he
of Matt Pond PA fame.
Yeah, you know, yes. Now he's just Matt Pond, but I haven't seen him in a number of years, but every time I did, he would mention that. Do you remember when I... Yeah, no, I did. How come we're not on the cover of Magnet? What, you did a big story on Pearl Jam and not Pond PA? I don't understand it. Did Eddie Vedder move you ever? No. It was good times.
You guys used to be surrounded by so many cool people, and now you're sitting here talking to me.
Yeah, no.
What happened?
That's the one sort of thing that I always... I mean, now Red Flag is publishing... Magnet.
Hang out with metal guys.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm just the editor.
But fake metal guys.
But yeah, when I was the publisher too, you know, people would always say, "Wow, you must have the most exciting job. You publish a music magazine." I said, "No, I basically sit in an office all day, and I spend money so John Valania can fly across the globe and you know go to Brian Wilson's house and drive Stephen Malkmus's car and what else?"
It sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah,
get bitten by Wayne Coyne's dog.
Yeah, there's a new pornographer story that John doesn't want to get into, but that was funny. I can't remember what movie I was in when you called me, but I missed half the movie being on the phone with you. I don't know. You have stories. Tell some good stories that I paid for back in the day.
Well, actually, before we get into my stories, did we even mention the High Fidelity thing? Were we going to talk about this? That was a pretty big moment.
Yeah.
Why don't you set that up? I guess Andrew's looking at us like,
Andrew doesn't remember that story.
What are you talking about?
This is called pee break for me. Just kidding. Here comes the story.
You know, but there. You're often contacted by these companies that do props for movies. And It's kind of strange, but anytime you see anything in a movie, it was cleared. You need to clear every single thing that's in the movie before they can shoot it. So they send you a contract, said this might be in the movie or whatever. So, you know, can you sign this? So we got those all the time. And I forget, some Drew Barrymore movie and some a bunch of stuff.
There were copies of Magnet were like in the background of a scene or something like that?
They were supposed to be. Uh-huh. Like all these times it's happened.
I didn't hear about these other movies.
Yeah, I would.
We've had that for Decibel for the worst fucking movies, like Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
Yeah.
And if this is going where I think it's going, then that's a little more substantial.
Yeah, but oftentimes, like, completely inappropriate stuff that, you know, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go see the Drew Barrymore movie to see Magnet in the movie. And then, of course, it wasn't in the movie. So
Jerky Boys, the movie.
Yeah. They were making High Fidelity, the John Cusack movie that Nick Hornby wrote the book of that it was based on. And it was cleared as a prop. And this happened a lot. This is sort of the golden age, like I said before, when people are spending a lot of money on stuff or whatever. And so it's like, okay, that's fine. Send them the issues. They give you a FedEx number. You know, you give them the issues. They request like 10 copies or whatever. So forgot about it. And then the week that it opens, suddenly all the reviews that are being published, the publicity photos, a copy of John Cusack reading Sleater-Kinney issue of Magnet behind the record store desk that he works at. And I'm getting emails excuse me, from people I went to high school with, like, oh my god, this is your magazine. You know, it like totally justified my life to them. You know, my parents are so excited, my in-laws are so excited. It was just like,
the magazine totally like, that was a mainstream moment. Like, that was really, we were like in the center of the radar there for a moment. Came out from our little indie rock basement, and
literally,
you know, we're picturing Entertainment Weekly and stuff like that. That was
cool. They ran the photo in like the New York Post, New York Times, in Entertainment Weekly. Then when the movie came out on DVD, they had somebody do an illustration of John Cusack reading the cover of Magnet, which is pretty awesome. I still have that.
That was for really? What?
It was when the DVD of High Fidelity came out.
I never saw that.
They had someone illustrate the photo, but instead of, like, if I would have, you know, illustrated the photo, I wouldn't have put the title of the magazine on the, you know, but he did. It was Magnet, and, you know, Sleater-Kinney, that was weird. But anyway, so we were so psyched.
The great irony of that story, John Cusack, illiterate.
Yeah.
just came out today.
Yeah.
I heard he was holding the magazine upside down in the
first
couple of early shots.
Yeah, to take a couple reshoots.
But yeah, I mean, to go back, so we were so excited. It's like the weeklies, they come out Wednesday and Thursday, and then the dailies come out Friday, and the press photo was just everywhere. So psyched. Go to see the movie. That scene was not in the movie. So I guess maybe John Cusack was actually reading Magnet on the set, and, you know, they were doing photos or whatever. Mm. Either that or they cut the scene.
No, I think they cut the scene. That was like, looked like that was, well,
they needed more Jack Black shucking and jiving. Maybe not shucking and jiving. What the fuck did I just say?
That was the movie that made Jack Black, people.
Yeah.
Thank us.
Because
that was our, we insisted on that. You couldn't use Magnet.
Story's not done yet.
You need more Jack Black. Sorry.
But then, really, you know, really we said, on. Okay, this, yeah, I know, the scene was cut. So, DVD, they have extras. So rent the DVD with the disc with the extras. Mm-hmm. Not in there either, you know. So I have no. I think he was just literally one day reading it, and someone happened to snap a photo. And
I think you're right. Then if it wasn't on the extras, I guess it probably wasn't. It wasn't ever supposed to be in the movie.
But I mean, you saw the magazine in the movie, but it was sort of,
it's a rock and roll mystery.
Yeah.
Did the mud shark ever happen? What became of Magnet and High Fidelity?
Yeah, I know.
Inquiring minds want to know.
I think John has a mud shark story. No, wait, no.
It was me and Zeppelin. We were in a hotel in Seattle. It was 73, I remember, and that's all I can remember about that. And then there was the Stones tour in 72, and I remember, in Altamont, that didn't go well.
Mm.
Let's see.
Bad
some of the
bit,
globe-trotting, jet-setting, let's see. I remember I weaseled a trip to Paris to go and interview Air. I remember I convinced the record company that somehow I could only do this in Paris. There's no way we could possibly do this near my house. And then we got, one of the best things.
Wait, what did they call the mullet hairstyle? The shrimp or something? Do you remember that?
I don't remember that part.
I actually read your stuff.
I do remember them saying English was the universal music of rock.
And they said rock is dead.
The universal language of rock. The universal language of rock. Yes, rock. We were standing at Jim Morrison's gravesite at the in Père Lachaise Cemetery, and it was me and the two guys from AIR, and they were just like, "Man, rock is really dead." And the cool one of the cooler things we'll fix that part there, right? We'll make it more interesting with the
give me some makeup.
More of that would be interesting.
Tom Waits was the big white whale that we finally landed, and that was dream come true. That was of all the people living left that I wanted to interview, Tom Waits was probably the guy. And I remember we got the green light to do that. He wasn't doing many interviews. I remember there was a lot that he turned down. It was around the Mule Variations era. I remember you guys put me up in this awful welfare motel,
Astro,
where it was just, you know. And like literally a pubic hair on the bathtub when I walked in.
We like
there
to take care of him.
Yeah.
Mysterious stains all over the sheets and the
headboard was off the bed.
Off the bed. There was literally a brick like holding up the one leg of the bed, and when you checked in, the front desk was to the hotel. On the other side of the front desk was a liquor store who the front desk clerk also ran the liquor store that they ran out the back, and most of the people that were staying there were stocking up. And I remember it was like 10 in the morning or something when we got there, and people were pretty lit. That was so awful we had to leave there. You couldn't even fathom that it could be that bad. You thought we were just whining about it, but
no.
But Tom Waits was just taken aback that we were there. He was taken aback.
Yeah, where are you guys staying? The Astro?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, when a place is too Fleabag for Tom Waits, you know, you got trouble. And then that weekend, and Tom was really cool. I mean, Tom was that was one of the best interviews that that I ever had pleasure of partaking in. But the coolest thing about that whole episode was that it was Tom Waits. So, you know, I dressed up. I had on a cool like porpoise hat and my leather jacket, sunglasses. You know, kind of like Tom Waits and circa.
That's what you're wearing now.
Down by Law. Exactly.
Weird.
And I remember, and Tom was just wearing. We went to this orchard out in the woods, where there was all these like scary gnarled trees, kind of like from The Wizard of Oz, where we were going to shoot the photos to go with the story. And Tom was wearing, at that point, he was always wearing like a denim jacket and denim pants and work boots. That was kind of his look at that time. He wasn't wearing suits during that period. Anyway, so they're taking a bunch of pictures, and Tom's looking over at me, and he's just like, "Yeah, that's a good look. That's a good Philly look." I'm like, that's cool. Tom Waits thinks I look pretty cool. And he's just like, "Let me see those sunglasses." So he takes my sunglasses and take a few pictures. He's wearing my sunglasses. He's like, "Let me see that hat." He takes my hat. He's wearing a hat and sunglasses. And he's like, take a few more pictures. And then he's like, "Let me see that jacket." Wear my jacket. I'm just like, this is fucking awesome. He's wearing all my clothes. And that didn't wind up being the cover shot, but that there's some of the interior shots where Tom Waits looks especially cool. It's really all my fault. And what was really cool about that was that I left directly from Tom Waits to flew down to Los Angeles to interview the only other person who was still alive that was like my doomed interview, which was Brian Wilson. I was like I was going through a really huge Beach Boys Brian Wilson phase at that point. I was really obsessed with the Smile bootleg tapes. And I remember we went to his met him in his mansion in Beverly Hills, which is a Mick mansion, by the way. And I remember
and he lived,
George Thorogood lived down the street, and
Shaquille
O'Neal was his next door neighbor. Mm. And anyway, I'm sitting in the living room. The publicist says, like, "All right, he's going to come in, and you have 15 minutes with him, and you know it." Anything could happen. He might just get up in the middle and walk out, and that'll be the end of it. So basically what I did is I had brought along I had a cassette of all these Smile bootlegs that I was always listening to all the time, and I started asking him a few questions. And I don't know if you've read or seen interviews with Brian Wilson, but it's you don't get much out of Brian Wilson these days. I guess I just put it that way. Interview was kind of not really going anywhere, so I just said, like, how about if we just, like, listen to some of this, how we just listen to some music, and put it on, put it on. And he wouldn't, I guess I should point out at this point that he would never talk about Smile at this point. Smile was this, like, really dark period in his life. It was kind of where things went south for him. He kind of never really came back from it, kind of never got out of bed at that point. Anyway, sat down and listened to it, and I remember just at one point he started, like, moving his head back and forth and was just sort of like, you know, yeah, this is pretty good. I'm like, it's really good, Brian. You know, you should get back to this. And I'm not saying that it was all me, but all I know is that, like, 2 or 3 years later, he finished Smile, and the rest is rock history.
Yeah. I introduced Paul and John back in the 60s. Should we wrap up? Or should we talk a little about, I mean, you know, we've been discussing 100 a lot. You know, 101 mm-hmm. is out. We discussed that a little bit. We have 102 coming out the beginning of September. And the weird thing, I mean, sort of not, like you said before, not to be too inside baseball, but the thing with doing a monthly magazine is, like, you forget what month it is. You're always working, like,
2 months ahead.
Yeah, 2 months ahead, 3 months ahead. People talk to you about the current issue, and you can't even remember what's in it because you're not only finished with the next one, but you're working on the next one and trying to plan out the one after that. So, but yeah, the next one that will be new to you people is issue 102 with mm-hmm. Tame Impala that we mentioned.
We're sure it's going to be a great cover story.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see how it turns out.
We better not get killed on the way back from this. Otherwise, there won't be a cover story. We have a really good story on Kathleen Hanna, who's in Bikini Kill.
Mm-hmm. Re-instigating the Julie Ruin.
Yeah.
Now with the.
With the. Fucked up reason. Julie Ruin before. Cool. Now it's the Julie Ruin.
Yeah.
If so, we might change it to the Magnet for that issue.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
While you're bringing that up, why is it called Magnet? That's a terrible name for a magazine.
The four of us wrote about 200 different names of a magazine before we started printing on a sheet of paper front and back.
Jugs was taken.
I was Jugs is the perfect name for this magazine.
Number two was Black Tail. I mean, and then it turns out that was taken as well.
Barely legal.
Mm-hmm. We just... You know, how does this name sound? Cross it off. How does this name sound? Cross it off. So then finally the last word on the sheet that wasn't crossed out was Magnet. And of all the people I started it with, I'm the only person who says that I'm not the one who came up with the name Magnet. Everyone else said, oh, no, that was me. and then would start making up stories about why it's, like, called Magnet. And it's just like, you know, I mean, it could have been called Carpet, you know what I mean? I mean, that was on the list, you know. It's like they had no meaning.
Carpet.
No, yeah, I mean, there's, like, literally, like, 200
with a K
words. Yeah, with a K.
Well, I'm glad that it basically came down to what was the least suckiest name you could call it. But kind of like band names too, though. I mean, it hopefully you're good enough that you transcend the name. Like Led Zeppelin, that's a terrible name if you think about it, but who thinks about that name?
Sure.
Beatles, that's a terrible name for a band, but who thinks about it? Because you think about their music, you don't think about the name.
Limp Bizkit. Same thing.
Yeah.
The accomplishment.
I think that's actually a pretty
name.
Good name.
I'm also excited. The lead review in that issue is they have a Clash box set coming out. That's
that's highly touted. Yeah. Well, it's somewhat redundant, from what I understand. But
but still,
maybe very redundant.
Clash,
but
it's the only band that mattered. And it just has
with no cut the crap.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they cut the crap.
Yeah.
out of the box set. they're one of my favorite bands of all time. I think London Calling is, you know, in my top five of all time. So it's. It's cool. It's cool when you get to write about stuff like that. That when you're growing up and you're in high school and you hear The Clash for the first time and it changes your life. And, you know, it's like, you know, when Vellani did a cover story on Paul Westerberg, I picked him up, or I didn't pick him up because I didn't have a driver's license at the time, but I met him to get in a cab. And
You picked up Paul Westerberg, not me.
No, not me. From the hotel and brought him to the place, which is only a couple blocks from where we are right now, to do the photo shoot. And, you know, I told him, I said, there is one day in high school where we pretended to go to the bus stop, me and like three other buddies, went over to somebody's house, and, you know, took his dad's Budweiser's out of the fridge. It's like 9 a.m. or 8 a.m. or whatever. And this kid was really into cool music, and he put on the Replacements. And that's the first I had ever heard of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think I'd be doing Magnet now if it wasn't for that day. That was like REM was the gateway drug, and then the Replacements were sort of like a little beyond the gateway drug. But that morning made me want to find out all this music that I didn't know.
You bring up REM. I think we should point out that was one of the stories, one of the cover stories that went pear-shaped, and it was kind of it's sad and tragic that it didn't work out, because they're both Eric and they were they were my favorite band in the 80s and the 90s for the longest, back when I still had favorite bands, and I think Eric was really big into them too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what I remember I was following around Peter Buck. We'll make a long story short. We did all the interviews, and then they wound up they reneged on their agreement that they would pose for a cover photo
because they ended up doing, because they knew their album was probably going to need heavy promotion, so they decided instead to do a free concert in Toronto that was outside, that was like 30,000 people, and then it was going to be broadcast on television. They thought that might get them more promotion than doing the cover of Magnet, which I can't imagine.
Wait a second. What record are we talking about specifically? Monster?
No, it was after that.
No. Reveal? Rings Around the Sun. Reveal.
Yes. Okay,
Reveal.
So way later. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about Dollar Bin Classic Monster.
No.
Yeah. No, if only. Yeah, the record was it was probably the worst REM record ever. But I was hanging out with, was part of the deal was I'd interviewed Michael Stipe, I'd interviewed Mike Mills, I was hanging out, I went record shopping with Pete Buck, they were up in New York doing press, and like we walked around Central Park, and I remember he bought me this Eric Dolphy record, it was really cool, and again, this is like hanging out with like this, you know, guys that like I worshipped in the 80s, it was really awesome, and he was playing with The Minus Five was doing he was the guitar player in the Minus Five. Is that right? The Minus Five? They were doing Conan, I believe it was. And so I was hanging out with them and in the dressing room waiting for them to go on. And all of a sudden, just their road managers kind of like, you know, gives me the finger, kind of, you know, come on over here, kid. And the next thing I know, I'm kind of being like escorted out of
the green room
and being escorted out of 30 Rock. And I'm like down, I'm looking at the ice skaters and I call on Eric and I'm just like, I just got thrown out of the dressing room. I don't even know why. And I think that was right around the time where I guess that's where we had already encountered this photo problem.
Yeah, no, it was their tour manager was also the tour manager of Mudhoney. And they were pissed off because what we called this story where have all the good times gone.
I wrote this story. I went out with Mudhoney on the road. They were out with Pearl Jam. And it was, you know, it was a little past the whole grunge era. It was past when they were no longer, you know, the bloom was a little bit off their rose. And the story was a little bit frank about, like, you know, here we are, like, you know, 35 years old and we're still the opening band and, you know, that kind
of
thing. And
yeah.
And I, you know, I guess they're just used to having so many, like, people writing these, like, fanboy puff pieces. And it wasn't like it was harsh or anything like that, but I guess it just wasn't glowing enough for them. Yeah, and the man, I guess it was that it was Bob Whitaker. And I guess he must have just figured out then who I was,
right? Yeah,
and had a little conference with Pete Buck, and they're like, "Don't do this."
Yeah, I mean,
he's gonna do a hatchet job on you.
And that's the thing too. After you do this for 20 years, like people hold grudges, and like they'll leverage one band or one venue or whatever against.
Look, this opens up the gates for a couple of quick stories that I'll put out there before we wrap this up. So speaking of holding grudges, there's several major indie rock figures that I have managed to get on their shit list over the years, for I think the most innocent of reasons. One was we were doing the Flaming Lips, and Steven Draws, the drummer, was telling me about how. He had gone to work on a Breeders record, the follow-up to Last Splash that was like years in the making, and there was just all these rumors about why couldn't they finish this record, or why wasn't what was going on, and Kelly was in rehab and Kim Deal was teaching herself how to play drums. Steve Draws told me the deal was that, like, you know, Kim Deal was just so smacked out of her head, and Steve Draws was admittedly a heroin addict as well, but it was too it was too druggy a scene for Steve Drozd even, and he wound up packing up his drums in the middle of the night and just leaving New York City. And I put that little story into the Flaming Lips story. Somehow that got back to Kim Deal, and like, you know, I was persona non grata forever, because I remember when the Breeders finally reunited a few years later, and I did an interview with Kelly Deal, and Kim was in the background, and she was just like, "Is that asshole from Magnet that wrote all that shit about heroin?" I was just like, you know, you mean the truth? You mean I was just telling you the truth? And in a related note too, I kind of blew the lid off the Wilco, the sort of the Wilco J. Bennett meltdown band reinventing itself. It was right when Yankee Hotel Foxtrot came out, and I kind of gotten like the inside story from, well, by that point J. Bennett was kicked out of the band, so basically he told me, and I went and visited him when I was out in Chicago and got his side of the story, and basically he was just like, you know, yeah, me and Jeff were messing around with a lot of Vicodin, and eventually we both got like hooked, and kind of like when we both kind of tried to get off of it was kind of where they sort of went their separate ways personality wise. I'm sure there's a number of other reasons in there, but I brought this up to Jeff Tweedy when I finally talked to him, and he was just apoplectic that I would ask somebody in a rock band about drug use. He was just apoplectic, and I basically kind of like cut off the interview, kicked me out. His publicist told me afterwards, when I finally wrote the story, she said that you probably wrote the best story I've ever read about Wilco, but Jeff Tweedy never wants to see you again. And I figured that was a pretty fair trade-off. But then the irony was is that the next album, he went into rehab like right before their album came out, and basically was like, you know, promoting the album on the back of his own addiction that he was so upset about me disclosing a year or two before. But years later, I actually went to, there was this guy in Philadelphia who was a dentist, who's a friend of mine named Anand, and he was, this was back in the post 9/11 days when the district attorney, John Ashcroft would go on the air. And he'd put up mugshots of the terrorists, and if anyone has seen these guys, and please report. This guy named Anand, he's Indian, half Indian, half American, not Native American Indian, India Indian. So he's got dark complexion and dark hair. Well, one of his patients like called the FBI on him, and basically he had to go down and kind of get interrogated by the FBI. So I wrote this story about him. I called him the Terror Dentist, but the thing of it was, he was a big Wilco fan, and he's like, "Can I wear my Wilco shirt for the picture that we're going to take with this article?" Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, totally. Wear the picture. Somehow Wilco got wind of this, and they put the story up on their website, and they wanted to offer Anand some two tickets to see them play at Radio City Music Hall. And I was just like, "You got to take me." And he's like, "Okay, fine, we'll take you." So we go there, and we go to the show, which was really amazing. And then we're walking past the side stage door, and their road manager comes out, this English guy, and he's just like, "You're that Terror Dentist bloke, aren't you? Oh, hold on, man. We're having a party upstairs. Hang on, I'll get you right in there." So he kind of takes us into, like, you know, the side stage door. We go up the elevator to where there's this Wilco after show party going on, and I'm just like, the whole time I'm just like, I hope they don't recognize me, because I don't know how this is gonna go. And we're standing there having a drink and looking around. The next thing you know, their manager Tony Margarita's like kind of takes me by the arm, and he's like, "Hey, let's go this way." And we get in the elevator. The next thing I know, the elevator door opens up and we're back down the street, and he's like, "Thanks," and kind of just ushers us out. And I was just like, wow, we just totally got kicked to the curb by Wilco.
You get kicked out of a lot of places.
Well, mm-hmm. You know, that's what happens when you tell the truth, yeah. Eric.
On that note, is what Andrew, happens maybe, when you tell the truth.
Maybe maybe we should get kicked out of this room.
Get kicked out of this room.
The engineer is not liking all all this honesty.
We have to save some shit talk for next time. But yeah, you've just encountered the first Magnet magazine podcast starring Jonathan Vlania, editor-in-chief Eric Miller, and yours truly, Andrew Bonazzelli. And if you really, really care about Magnet, which you must have because you've been listening to this for 75 minutes, go check out our Wikipedia page and update it.
Yeah, please.
Because that thing just it's fucking sucks.
Like they say, we don't cover gangster rap. I mean, come on. I mean, magnetic fields. Whoa. I mean, who's more gangster rap than magnetic fields? My God.
Help us out. Now you can transcribe this entire thing and utilize it for Wikipedia for the benefit of...
Can't we just fix our own Wikipedia page?
That's kind of cheating, isn't it?
No, it's not cheating, but it's also arduous and painful.
We should also, you know, say subscribe to Magnet.
You know? Sure. There's a URL,
Alex,
for
that
you're probably on.
Yeah, no, there you go.
You're probably on this URL if you're listening to it. But
yeah, subscribe.
Another great ending.
Yeah, all right.
Maybe we'll see you guys in a month or something.
Or when we do issue 200.
Issue 200.
In another 100 years.
Yeah.
Peace out.
All right. Thanks.